Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Very well. How are you today?
I'm well. We have Chef Michael White on later in the show. He is the executive chef of L'Impero and Alto restaurants in New York
also,
City.
Also owner of a little restaurant here in New Jersey.
And a great place, and we're looking forward to talking with him. But we're going to spend the first segment today talking about And I Told You So, and it's something that I'm sorry we were right on.
Sometimes I don't want to be right.
But it's
loving you is wrong.
But this is a complex issue, and that's what we do in the restaurant, guys. We can talk for a few minutes about a complex issue. It doesn't have to be 60 seconds. Ethanol is wrong. Ethanol is a bad idea.
Well, it's a mistake.
It's a mistake. And a lot of people of goodwill have gotten on the ethanol train for the right reasons, but it's wrong. And we need to look a little more deeply into ethanol. And a lot of people of bad will, a.k.a. Rush Limbaugh, are bashing ethanol because Rush Limbaugh believes that global warming is a hoax, fuel shortages are a hoax, that we'll have oil forever, and we should... And we should not do anything in the name of conservation or lowering our carbon footprint.
I think it's funny. A lot of the people who don't believe in global warming now all of a sudden, I'm sorry, don't believe in
man-made global warming,
originally didn't believe in global warming at all, and now have kind of said, okay, the Earth is getting warmer, but, well, that's just a natural effect.
So for 10 years they said it didn't exist, and they were wrong. And now they say it's not our fault.
And they're wrong again.
You know, Rush Limbaugh doesn't believe in a lot of things. You know, gravity, things like that. it's just a theory. A theory of gravity is just a theory. But here's the thing about biofuels. Number one is it's causing, as we had said all along, a worldwide rise in food prices. Now, that's a complex issue because if a lot of the world's food prices were allowed to float to what they actually cost, that wouldn't be a bad thing. And some food prices would rise in certain regions. One of the things that happens is, let's take American corn, for example. The way we subsidize American corn is sold for less than it costs to make American corn. Well, what does that do to...
Which is the mistake we made 40 years ago or 50 years ago and have never reconciled.
Well, it's because it's not the little farmers don't make a lot of corn. It's the big agribusiness concerns that own a lot of corn, miles and miles and miles of corn. Well, what does that do? That corn being so artificially cheap is cheaper than a Mexican farmer can produce it. And let's put it this way. Mexican labor is pretty cheap, and they're farming the land themselves, and the land is cheap. But it's still cheaper than a Mexican farmer can produce on his own farm for his own village. So what happened? That Mexican farmer goes out of business and comes looking for work in North America. And then we are outraged that they're looking for work. We're outraged that they're trying to cross the border looking for work after our government-subsidized corn has put him out of business.
It's a different argument, but we'll talk about that another time.
That's one of the problems with subsidized corn. The other problem with subsidized corn is now we're using this subsidized corn.
I want to talk about one other thing before you go into it. The subsidy of corn has created artificially cheap corn in this country.
Right.
So to all of us, the presumption that corn should be 10 cents an ear, 15 cents an ear, 25 cents an ear.
Or industrial corn should be 2 cents an ear.
Right, industrial corn should be 2 cents an ear, is unreasonable. It's unreasonable to think that we should be producing corn for human consumption at 10 cents an ear and for animal consumption at 2 cents an ear is unreasonable because we can't really do that without our government paying someone to to do that.
And one of the things we want to be clear about is that we favor letting corn rise to somewhere near what its market price is, which will empower farmers across the world to farm corn again. So I'm not saying that every rise in price is a bad thing, but if it's a rise in price in the aim of better economic health, that's one thing.
We just want corn to cost what corn costs. That's all.
But what's happening now is you have subsidized corn that, even though we're subsidizing it, is rising in price because we also subsidize ethanol production, and we give tax breaks for ethanol production. So we're taking corn that is cheaper to the guys who make it. We externalize the costs. That's really more expensive than it has to be, to make ethanol that winds up being cheaper than gasoline, but only because it's subsidized by the government. So it's not really cheaper.
And the only reason corn is cheaper than gasoline, I'm sorry, ethanol is cheaper than gasoline, is because we're subsidizing that corn production. The big problem with ethanol, okay, and I don't have a huge problem with biofuels because I do think that there's ultimately a marketplace there for biofuels, but corn and ethanol in its current incarnation isn't the answer.
Well, and one of the reasons is, say we take the subsidies away from it. Say if we took the subsidies away, they still found a way to produce that corn cheaply. It doesn't really reduce greenhouse gases, which is one of the other things. While, yes, burning a tank full of ethanol produces fewer greenhouse gases than burning a gallon of undiluted gasoline, the problem is, by optimistic estimates, producing a gallon of ethanol from corn uses most of the energy the gallon contains. In other words, because of the tractors and fertilizers and all the carbon-intensive stuff that goes into raising corn, it takes a gallon of gasoline to produce a gallon of ethanol. We then put in the gasoline.
Well, it takes a gallon of energy. We won't necessarily say that it's gasoline. It could be anything.
That's a gallon of energy that's derived from oil sources. So the net impact on the planet is the same or worse.
It's worse.
But it's a shell game that these big companies perpetrate on us because they pick up subsidies along the way. So they basically take 1 gallon of energy, produce 1 gallon of energy from it, and profit from it all along the way.
Well,
and that cost comes from the taxpayers. That's where their profits come from.
And for me, the worst part of all of this is, in this country, corn is a very intensive crop. We need to do a lot to make our corn grow to the way we want it
to
grow.
And it's mostly genetically modified at this point.
And we're growing too much corn in this country already for what the land should be growing. So what we're creating is a demand for more corn. We did that already, and we made corn syrup out of it. And that's what we did because it was cheap to grow corn instead of sugarcane or beets or other places to get corn. So we created this corn syrup market because we made corn artificially cheap. Now we're creating this ethanol market because we've made corn artificially cheap. And we're doing it wrong.
Well, and there's another policy out there. In Brazil, they're using ethanol from sugarcane. Except, of course, that accelerates the pace of climate change by deforesting Brazil. So that's not working there either. So there's a little we told you so. We're in a pickle, everybody, but we have to think the problem through. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Chef Michael White. He's executive chef and partner at two of New York City's most critically acclaimed restaurants, Alto and L'Impero, both favorites of ours. He's with us today to discuss his love of Italian cuisine and talk about running two of the best kitchens in New York.
Chef Michael White, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you walked right into running two kitchens. You took over, was it 2 years ago, last year?
No, it was last year. It was... Gosh, it's already about 10 months has gone past, but I had left my former post at Fiamma Downtown, which I opened in 2002, and went on a little bit back to another sabbatical to Italy, and got in conversation with Chris Cannon, and he's the owner, managing partner of the restaurant, and we hit it off and started chatting, and all of a sudden now, as 10 months have gone by, and we've received 3 stars from the New York Times at Alto and 2 stars from the New York Times at L'Impero's, and things are, knock on wood, going great.
A sabbatical sounds great.
Yeah, we're a little jealous of your sabbatical. Well, now, but what's it like to walk into running two different restaurants? I mean, it's not like you started with L'Impero and then went to Alto. You came in and took over the helm of both restaurants simultaneously. Talk to us about that.
You know, it's something that I'm one of the luckiest guys in New York City, if not the country. Cooking an Italian food is something that is what I've always done. I've never done outside of Italian food, apart the fact of being in the south of France for a while, but that's very Mediterranean-based. But I started at Spiaggia back in 1991, cooking Italian food, and, you know, worked in Italy for about 7 years, traveled Italy, worked in the south of Italy. And what's happened is we've taken L'Impero and we've moved it very much to the south of Italy in flavor. And then at Alto, I have a northern Italian approach, not just one certain region, but, you know, Piedmont, Tuscany, anything I kind of say like Florence and up.
Why don't you explain to our listeners the difference between those two very different areas of Italy?
It is very much the south of Italy is people, you know, really liking it to have, you know, more tomato-based than the north of Italy, where in the north of Italy it's very much eggs, cheese, lots of different cuts of meat, prosciutto, salami, all those different things. I mean, there's salami in the south of Italy, but the use of dry pasta in the south of Italy is much more prevalent than in the north of Italy. It's really a different type of approach of cooking, very, very simplistic, not much use of milk in those types of products. And it's the cucina di sole, which is the cuisine of the sun, really, is the south of Italy, where the north of Italy is very much different in the sense that there's the mountains and the Austrian influences and the Germanic influences in Italian cooking, where you go all the way to the bottom to Sicily, and there's Norman influences and Tunisian. I mean, it's very, very close to Italy. Pardon me, Sicily is very, very close to the coast of Africa, and there's the couscous competition every year in Sicily. And, you know, so I'm so lucky that I have this broad palate to do both types of cooking. One different at L'Impero and one at Alto. Italy is probably one of the most diverse countries for food, where spetzle in the north and you have couscous in the south. So
well, in this country, we have the habit of just saying Italian food, and Italian food is such a broader array, and you're fortunate, and I think, in your ability to have two restaurants to cover the two basic different areas, but you could have 25 different restaurants covering
areas
of Italy.
Absolutely. You know, the great part about cooking Italian food now is that people, until the euro got so high, but people have been traveling a lot to Italy, whether they go to Rome and Florence and Venice, and, you know, you can no longer cook Italian food the way we used to, because people have traveled, they've tasted it, they've seen it, and people are much more food savvy now.
You know, it's interesting. We opened our first restaurant is a contemporary American restaurant. And the second restaurant we opened up is we call it an Italian American restaurant because we found a lot of value in Mark's family's cuisine, which is an Italian American cuisine.
My family's been in this country for 100 years, though,
and right. It's an Italian American cuisine from Brooklyn. But I think that, you know, while there's value in that, it's not Italian cuisine. It's based in Italian cuisine, and it's also a cuisine that's been much bastardized and watered down, even from the you know, there's a lot of bad food being served under the rubric of Italian cuisine in America for a long time.
No, and it's that's our my biggest challenge, and I talk about this all the time, is in French food, for example, they can go outside of the box. They can use curry, and they can use lemongrass. You know, we're not going to name chefs, but and they still call it French food. But if I was doing that, I would be, like, looked upon in New York City that, hey, what are you doing? You know, the press has this perceived concept of what Italian food is, and it is now for the press. They're in a wine bar with lots of bottles of wine on the wall. they're having sliced meats and a plate of gnocchi with tomato sauce, and there's like a rolling hill behind it. And Italian people, I mean, that's what the journalists want Italian to be. They're not allowing Italian chefs to cook in the high kitchen, you know, a lot of times.
We need to take a break, but when I come back on the other side, I want to talk about that very interesting topic of authenticity. We'll be back in just a moment with Michael White of L'Impero and Alto Restaurants in New York City. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi Restaurants, and we're talking with Michael White of L'Impero and Alto Restaurants in New York City. We were talking before the break, Michael, about authenticity and how French chefs and people and the press and the public give French chefs a lot more latitude to think outside the box, and they really keep Italian chefs, they only allow a narrower definition of Italian food. But why don't you talk to us about the idea of authenticity of an Italian restaurant in New York City, which isn't in Italy and uses a lot of local ingredients? What makes an Italian restaurant an Italian restaurant?
You know, it's plain and I can answer this in one thing. It's called taste memory. It would be impossible to cook Italian food if you didn't live outside of America and go to Italy to study and to really not just learn how to cook but absorb the culture and the way Italians eat. Having fresh ricotta from the dairy that's warm still, and to lock in that taste memory, you start to develop this what I call taste memory. And the palate of Italian cooking, and in order to be authentic, I mean, it's much easier now than it was when I first started cooking in the 90s because the amount of product that's coming into the United States every week, every month is getting much better as for, you know, procuring cheese and different all different types of Italian food products. I like to tell Italian people when I'm living in Italy or when I'm in Italy traveling. That it's easier for me to get a certain type of Italian cheese than it would be for you, because let's say you lived in Bologna and you wanted a caciocavallo from somewhere down south, they don't have it. They would have to order it. I can go to Murray's Cheese Shop, pick up the phone, and I can have it to my doorstep faster than they can. You know, it's so global now in New York City. We're fortunate. If you want to have scampi or if you want to have vongole veracci from Italy, you can have anything you want. You have to pay for it, and with that comes a cost and a price tag. But you can get anything you want.
Yeah, even in the wine world, we hear sometimes that the Bordelais can get a better Burgundy when they're in New York City than they can when they're in Bordeaux.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll come back after the news on the other side of the news and talk more with Michael White about the state of Italian food in America and his two fine restaurants in New York City. So come back with us after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1130.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys, a I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Michael White is executive chef and partner at two of New York City's most critically acclaimed Italian restaurants, L'Impero and Alto. And we're talking with him today about his restaurants specifically and Italian food in general in America. Now, Michael, did you grow up in an Italian household? I mean, where does your love of Italian food come from?
You know, I'm Norwegian, of Norwegian descent. My grandmother was from Norway, and so food was always very, very important at home. I'm from Wisconsin, outside of Milwaukee.
Yeah, I understand that the Norwegian community of Wisconsin has a tremendous Italian-American restaurant scene. What?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was always cooking in the kitchen. And we would go, there's a very heavy populated Sicilian population outside of Chicago. And so that's the kind of food we grew up with. When you went to go eat Italian, it was always that, you know, the great pizza. And, you know, I just kind of fell into it. I wanted to do Italian. I loved Italian. And I went to work at Spiaggia as a young person before I started cooking school just to see if I liked it. And when I got there, all this, you know, they were cooking risotto, and I'd never seen risotto. Nobody knew what risotto was back in 1991. You know, they're stirring and it's creamy and this whole thing. And I just was mesmerized by Italian cooking, so I've never wavered from it, and then that's really how I got involved with it.
And then when do you go off to Italy?
I went in the fall of 93 to Italy. I worked for a couple of years straight at Spiaggia. And saved up all my pennies, and that time, back in the 90s, it was about 2,600 lira to the dollar, which was amazing.
Yeah, it was better than for us.
Oh, yeah. And I had the idea of staying for, well, 3 or 4 months and kind of soak it up, and, you know, went through the whole homesick, you know, stuff, and that turned into a year. I came back, worked for 6 months, and went back for another 2 years, and on and off was there about 7 years. So I married my wife in Italy, and she's from Imola, outside of Bologna, where Restaurant San Domenico is, and that's really where I spend a lot of my time. And so I'm very, 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 very Italian now. We have a daughter, Francesca, and I am. We only speak in Italian at home, and Italian really is almost my first language with Italian kids that I have working with me. And I'm surrounded all, you know, whether it be white wine with Eric Zillier at the restaurant, which you guys know. And
yeah.
Very good friend of ours.
And all the things I do are all Italian-based. Whenever we travel, it's always about food. And so,
now, when did you first come to adopt the Italian language? Did you learn it in school, or did you learn it when you were cooking over there?
I like to say I went to Italy with ciao and cappuccino. That's the only two words that are, that's what I knew.
And nobody likes to say goodbye to their cappuccino.
Right. And you know, you're baptism by fire, I like to say. You know, you get there and you have to sink or swim, and you start learning how to speak Italian. Obviously, if I was in a big city, a lot of people speak English, but I was in a small town of about 60,000 people, and when I was walking around 6'4", and blonde hair and blue eyes, everybody knew me in the town. And at any rate, you start to pick it up slowly, and having a good grasp of Spanish, it is somewhat similar, but not really. You know, it takes a few years, but you can make yourself understood after about 6 months or so.
I lived in France for a time, and what I realized is how little French I learned in French class.
Right, absolutely.
You know, it's funny. I went to Spain as a young man, and all the only words I had were chow and cappuccino, and those aren't even Spanish words. But I soon realized that, number one, the only way that I could talk to Spanish girls was if I learned how to speak Spanish. And,
you got it.
And number two, I do find that if you're in a situation, rather than in a classroom setting, where, number one, you need to do it, number two, you can have a few glasses of wine to loosen up your inhibitions, you pick up a language much quicker.
It's true, and I always like to say, you know, at first I went there for the la cucina, and then I went there for the culture, and also for the chicks. it's quite for a 21-year-old kid from Wisconsin that was working in Chicago, and all of a sudden you have all these beautiful Italian women and going to Rome and Venice, and that was, it's pretty cool.
So I've got it. I think the three of us should start a language school.
Yeah.
And what we'll do is we'll make the professors attractive women.
Okay.
And every class starts with two glasses of wine.
I'm all in. I think it'd be quite successful. So now, you're coming from the Midwest, being 6'4", blonde, blue-eyed, of Norwegian descent, American, sort of really adopting Italian culture and then bringing that back to America, was there the temptation to just stay in Italy? Is there the temptation to go back to Italy and do what you do there? Or is this the right mix for you?
It's definitely the right mix. It's something that, you know, we travel to Italy quite often, at least 2 times a year, and whether it be for research or for relaxation. But even when we're there for relaxation, it's always, you know, research. We're always going to eat. And, you know, the United States is my home, and I had to convince my wife to come with me here, but she loves it because New York is so very international that she doesn't feel as a stranger in the United States. And you know, it's a great balance. Food is what I do, and you don't have a lot of hobbies other than food because we are so much always in the restaurant, as you both know. And so your friends come to the restaurant, and it's a great balance. I really love what I do, and if I made half of what I make, I would still do what I do.
Well, don't tell your partners.
No, exactly. Just how many people did I just tell that?
Now, you can also, let's remember that if Michael also, if you're listening, Michael also, if he made double, he would still continue to do these things. So let's remember that. Now, Food & Wine magazine recently in an editor's letter just this year listed your shredded radicchio and pioppini mushrooms wrapped in aged beef carpaccio as a, quote, and I quote, a perfect dish. You're operating at a pretty high level, and I do think that you are pushing the envelope of the box. And but what do you think makes great Italian food, and what do you think is sort of a sham in restaurants, maybe not in New York City, but in the country? Like I said, I think there are a lot of crimes committed against the public in the name of Italian food or Italian-American food. Talk to us about what makes it authentic and real and on a high level. Where is that line?
Well, I tell you, the line is that you can travel Italy over and not find certain things that people here think are inherently Italian. You know, for a perfect case in point, you have an espresso in the United States, and people put lemon peels on it. Why do they put lemon peels? Because when the Italian immigrants came from Italy, they found a coffee that wasn't strong enough to do their little mocha or their espresso. And so what they did was they put those coffee grains in a sauté pan, and they would toast them to get them darker. And then all of a sudden they would become acrid and burned, so they put a little lemon twist on the side to kind of cut that acrid acidity taste. You know, there's all these little things. Why is there garlic bread? Because when they came here, there was this soft hoagie bun type of thing, but there wasn't olive oil. So they brushed it with butter, and they put garlic powder on it, and all of a sudden that's born. You know, that's very much Italian-American. Is it Italian? Not at all. Is it something that, you know, we enjoyed as kids growing up? Absolutely. You know, there was nothing better than going to an Italian friend's house and they were cooking sauce with meatballs in it. Polpette, or meatballs, are very, very small. My wife is from southern Italy in Molise, and there they have polpettine, which are these little meatballs that are braised in a light tomato sauce. That's very Italian. You could find those, but you would never find large meatballs.
We you know, there's in this country we serve a 6-ounce meatball that you would never see anything near that in it.
Yeah, right. So, you know, the fine line, you know, I don't think it's a very fine line. It's a very distinct line in the sense that when you're cooking Italian, like the carpaccio, you know, instead of, you know, pounding out the carpaccio, putting these pickled pioppini mushrooms, those, you know, all those mushrooms, all those things, the Castelfranco radicchio that comes from Treviso this time of year. Those are all Italian ingredients, and then what we do is we take this great beef that we get in the United States, because you can travel Europe over and nobody has beef like we have in the United States, and pound it very thin, and then roll it up kind of like a piece of sushi or an involtino, and then slice it, and then put it. So it's all the Italian flavors. We just kind of package it differently, and if you'd have a carpaccio like that, it would, you know, that taste memory, it would taste very much. It's just presented in a different way.
You know, the fact of the matter is cuisine is always evolving, and individual chefs are always evolving, but it's about a frame of reference.
Right.
Michael, when we come back, I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about a project that you're doing here in New Jersey, and I want to talk about your relationship to Catherine Zeta-Jones.
Okay.
I've always dreamed of having a relationship with Catherine Zeta-Jones, but it's never come true. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by-the-glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years' experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi, and we're speaking today with Chef Michael White of Alto and Lampiro restaurants in New York City. You can find out more about those restaurants by going to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll have a link up later this afternoon.
Michael, I think some of our listeners might be surprised to know that you spent a little time in the kitchen with Catherine Zeta-Jones, didn't you?
I did. I did indeed. It was, the movie No Reservations was based on the German film that came to America, but they did a twist on it in the sense that she was a chef in the village in Soho, the village, that area of town. And so they were looking for a restaurant that had those types of qualities, and they came and approached us if we'd like to do some. You know, they wanted to film the restaurant and to see how the kitchen moved and those things at Fiamma. And then what happened was that they then told us who was going to be in the movie. And they also approached me to see if I would be interested in helping that person. And it was Catherine Zeta-Jones. So that was, what am I going to say, no?
Exactly.
So we really hit it off, and we worked about 3 weeks together. With Catherine Zeta-Jones, Aaron Eckhart, and Abigail Breisland, who is the girl that was in Little Miss Sunshine.
So you didn't pull a Gordon Ramsay on her and scream at her and stuff.
No.
I would imagine that it'd be a more gentle sort of a training.
Absolutely.
With Catherine Zeta-Jones.
So some of her moves in that movie are your moves, actually.
Oh, definitely. The scallop scene, all those things when we were sauteing scallops, and we went through a ton of scallops.
It's okay, they can afford it. So now, what was it like teaching her? What did they want her to learn? Did they really want her to learn how to cook a dish, or did she really want to learn how to cook a dish? Was it fun, or was it just learning how to act like you're cooking?
You know, I tell you, it was a great experience. Number one, the experience shows me that cooking, I would rather cook for 500 people with one arm tied behind my back than be on a movie set, because, you know, it is just painstaking to I was... First, as a teacher to her, and then as an on-site director assistant, like helping him, the technical director, helping Scott Hicks, the director of the movie, to say, hey, does that look right? You know, is the cook's movement? And most of my training with her was the fact of like how to hold your towel, how to sauté, how to make it look real, not a dish per se, because she wasn't cooking dishes on TV. Are on the film, it was just the movements and how you hold your pan, how do you sauce a plate, your posture, all those types of things.
And did you find that it took them a while to sort of get that down? Because, you know, it's funny that you don't think of it. This is something that someone who's a professional, you know, does every day for their whole career. And there is sort of a way to do it.
There's a dance. There's a dance that a chef and the people he works with do together.
You know, they came into the restaurant, and they would just sit. She would just sit there and watch me, and yelling for tickets, and you know how you not yelling, but you know, well, all right, a little bit of yelling.
Yeah.
And, being vocal enough to be
on
heard.
On a scale of one to Gordon Ramsay, it's a four.
Yeah. And, you know, she would, and, you know, how you kind of peer into the window, you know, with the pass and all those types of things. And she, and then she would go behind the line and cook, you know, with the guys and kind of movement and learn how to move back and forth with the cooks. And, there was also a scene in the movie where she had to go out to the dining room and, I don't know, stab the steak or whatever. And so she practiced going into my dining room there and, we had a lot of fun with it. With the runners who run the food, we gave her the dish. I don't remember what the dish was, but she put it down, and this guy looked at her, and she had a beautiful black cashmere sweater on and a white apron. And the guy looks at her and said, "You know, you look a lot like Catherine Zeta-Jones." She said, "Oh, I get that all the time." And she ran back into the kitchen. So she had a great time with it.
I hope that guy. I hope that guy's listening to this radio show right now. Yeah. That was me.
Well, we have to talk about this project you're doing here in New Jersey. Due Tete is a restaurant in Bernardsville that you opened with a guy who worked with us for a while, Francois Rousseau. And it's been in Bernardsville now for a little while. And why don't you tell us about that project?
You know, it's having the outlet of going to New Jersey, and we're in Bernardsville, and I'm sure your listeners know Bernardsville. Something that is just a beautiful area. We have a wonderful clientele, and you know, we'd like to think we're giving them the kind of, you know, the Italian atmosphere without going into the city. That was really, we wanted to give a you know, the wine and food experience on a relaxed level, though not something. And things are going very, very well, and knock on wood, we're doing great.
Well, and what's it like being on the other being on the both sides of the Hudson River? Is that coming across? Is that present a problem? I mean, your other two restaurants being within Manhattan, it's a lot easier to get back and forth from one to the other.
It's great for me because I get to drive my car. I get to drive my car 30 miles down to 287 and to Vernonsville. Now, it's not really. You know, we're doing new spring menu now out there, and I'll be out there this weekend. It's fun for me. I really enjoy it, and we have such a good clientele base, and lunch is good.
And the restaurant's really good. I've been there myself and to visit Francois, and I was very impressed.
Thank you, thank you. No, it's something that we'll probably do something else again in New Jersey. You know, it's being in New York City, you're on spectacle all the time, as you guys were talking about before. And you know, these young people from the kitchen from the school say, "Chef, do you ever do competition?" You know, because that's really big in schools and the cooking schools. And I say, "I'm in competition every single day."
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And they'll cut your legs out from under you here in New York City, you know, if you make one mistake.
Well, Michael, we need to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
we'll
Michael.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Michael White, great chef. I'd had his food at the old Fiamma when he was the chef
at
Fiamma.
He was at Fiamma. Now he's doing Alto and Limpero, and now this new project, well, relatively new project in Bernardsville, New Jersey.
But his wine director in New York is Eric Zillier, a friend of ours, great guy, and a talented wine director. You know, it's funny how he mentioned how the American meatball. You both were talking about the large American meatball that you wouldn't find in Italy. And I remember reading that the American meatball came about because when the Italians immigrants had recently come over and they were living in the slums, and the progressives among the then predominant white Anglo-Saxon Americans, social workers went into the Italian slums and were looking to make sure everybody had a good diet. But, of course, it was their own version of what was a good diet.
Well, it had to have protein. It had to have meat.
Had to have meat. You know, meat was more important than vegetables from their viewpoint. And so they asked what the kids were having. They were having all these this pasta and all this tomato sauce, and there wasn't meat at every meal. And the progressive social workers convinced these Italian immigrants who wanted to be American that their kids were unhealthy and they had to have meat at every meal.
And they had to find was an inexpensive source of meat that would marry with the foods that they were already producing.
And so the meatball was born.
Chopped meat, one of the most inexpensive meats that there is.
And out of the scraps of several different kinds, pork, meal, veal, beef, whatever's
veal,
around.
Right. Basically, a meatball in the early 1900s was any meat that you had. It was you know, could go into a meatball. It wasn't just beef, or it was a mixture.
And I like them still. Okay, like Italian food, like Italian American food, like American food. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott,
and I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.